evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome. Welcome to book, chapter, and verse 133 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio exclusively right here on the listener-supported Head On Radio Network. Also brought to you in part by Coal River Mountain Watch. That's crmw.net. Please stop by Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and have a look at what mountaintop removal is doing to West Virginia. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Monday, April 21st, 2008. So if you're listening on a Monday evening, April 21, 08, shortly after 9 p.m. Eastern, you are indeed listening to a live show, and you are welcome to call in and participate with myself and to the guest I'll be introducing shortly. The toll-free line is 877, the number 4-HEAD-ON. That's 877-4-HEAD-ON. The toll line, in case you have unlimited long distance, you'll save the studio a nickel or a buck, is area code 304-658-3333. That's 304-658-3333, and that rings in West Virginia. Email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com. That's Peter at headonradionetwork.com. So you're more than welcome to participate in the show either by calling one of the two numbers or sending an email. You can also join us at the show in the chat room, which is active as I speak. You'll find a link to the chat room at strictlyconfidentialradio.com. In addition to the chat room, you'll find links to the guests' websites and to the audio archives from all of the past shows, and the chat room is active as I speak, a good night to stop in. You'll find links also at strictlyconfidentialradio.com to the Head On Radio Network main site. You can find out about all of the other progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network, of which I'm only a small part. There are links there also for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page and links to help you locate the music that you hear on the show. You'll also find at headonradionetwork.com the PayPal button to help keep the Head On Radio Network streaming. Keeps the packets passing and the hard drives spinning and the CPU fans whirring along up there in the undisclosed hidden location in the hills of West Virginia. Hope you all had a wonderful weekend. I had a quiet weekend and got to take in a few movies. Doggy and I were very, very quiet over the weekend. We enjoyed ourselves tremendously, primarily in the horizontal position, which is the best position I know of to watch movies. In case you're tuned in Friday evening, you'll recall we did the disturbing story in great detail about Satinder Singh. Now, Mr. Singh is a young man, or was a young man, only 26 years old, and as I have spoken to our guest today, who is Mr. Jerry Sloan. Jerry has indicated to me that Mr. Singh had just come out. Mr. Singh was murdered there in a park in Sacramento next to a lake. They were celebrating Singh's promotion. Singh was out at the picnic tables with six of his friends, three married couples. And we're talking about the traditional married couples. The folks that were there, the Russians who were there, the people who were immigrating from Bulgaria and the Baltics, rather, I should say the Baltics, not necessarily Bulgaria, didn't care for that very much. And we told the story of how the confrontation escalated and how Mr. Singh was murdered at the end of the day. And we were trying to understand that, how this group called Watchmen on the Walls. By the way, Watchmen on the Walls, the Southern Poverty Law Center has reported that it is has classified it as a hate group. And many of the activists, or the Slavic activists in the Sacramento area, are members of Watchmen on the Walls. In any case, we were hoping to arrange for Jerry Sloan, or a member of Project Toscan, which is a Sacramento-based group that monitors the religious right, to join us this week and shed some light on it and explain the situation more clearly about what's happening in Sacramento. And in fact, we I have Jerry Sloan with us this evening, who is the founder of Project Toscan there in Sacramento. Now, I must tell you, Jerry Sloan is many, many things. It'll be a very interesting interview. You should stick around most definitely for it. Jerry Sloan was born in Kansas City, Missouri, and attended the local schools, graduated from Westport High School in 1954. Then he enrolled in Baptist Bible College in Springfield, Missouri, where he graduated in 1957 with a graduate of theology degree. Now, since the 70s, Jerry Sloan's been a prominent gay activist in Missouri and Kansas and Iowa and Texas and California. He has been referred to by the media and others as Gusty, a hero, a demagogue, a nutcase, a fascist, and a scumbag. He's been on countless radio and television programs. He's been his articles and quotes and interviews have appeared in newspapers, periodicals like The Advocate, Time, Newsweek, People Magazine, the U.S. News and World Report. His research on the radical religious rights appeared in the Sacramento Bee, Los Angeles Times, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, the list goes on and on. And if that's not enough to keep you tuned in to listen to Mr. Jerry Sloan, you'll also find about Sloan and Limbaugh, Sloan versus Limbaugh, I should say, also Sloan versus Falwell, Sloan versus Baptist Bible College, Sloan versus Robinson, that's evangelist James Robinson, by the way. Yes, indeed, when we say that we have an activist on the show this evening, we indeed have an activist who has earned his stripes. He has awards from everyone from Advocate magazines as being one of our 200 best and brightest, meaning 200 of the LGBT community's best and brightest, to a leadership service by the Interfaith Religious Liberty Association, Outspoken Atheist Award from Atheists and Other Free Thinkers of San Francisco, a Humanitarian of the Year Award, the San Sacramento Human Rights Fair Housing Commission. I could do a whole hour just introducing this man, but there's no point in it. We have him on the line. Jerry Sloan, thank you for joining us on Strictly Confidential. Good evening, Jerry.
Good evening, Peter. It's a pleasure to be with you, and thank you for all those kind words.
Well, Jerry, it took a little time to decide which of your illustrious past to even tell them about. I've got to tell you, the conversation we had on the phone this morning when we were setting this up was not only delightful, it was jaw-dropping. You've certainly run the gamut, my friend.
Yes. Yes, I've been able to be on the front lines in a lot of battles around the country, and particularly out here in California for the last 28 years. It's serious, but I want to say it's been fun too.
Jerry, what brought you to Sacramento 28 years ago?
Well, I came out to work with the local Metropolitan Community Church. For any of your listeners who are not familiar with the Metropolitan Community Church, it was founded in 1968 by the Reverend Troy Perry, who is gay, and was to be an outreach to gay Christians who were being rejected by their various denominations. And in 1973, we had a church open in Kansas City, and I started attending and decided to try and take up my ministerial career again after I'd been rejected by my fundamentalist Baptist church several years prior to that.
Well, now, Jerry, when I spoke with you on the phone today, you mentioned that the Bible college you were involved in wasn't just Southern Baptist. It was a whole other flavor of Baptist. Tell us a little about that. I'm sure we talk about Baptists a lot here.
Well, the Baptist Bible College was supported by a group called the Baptist Bible Fellowship, and it was made up of young ministers primarily who had left the Southern Baptist Convention prior to that because the Southern Baptists were modernists. They were. And these guys were, we were to the right, but to the far right of the Southern Baptist Convention. And
wow.
So it was while I was in school there that I I met Jerry Falwell, and we became close friends, and met a lot of other prominent men who are prominent in the ministry today, and so within that organization. But we were very fundamentalist. I mean, you know, it's God said it, that's it. You know, we don't go any further than that.
I understand. Well, Jerry, I should ask you, you spent time with Jerry Falwell in your youth and in his youth, and if I understand, you were not only classmates, but you were very good friends. What was Jerry Falwell like before he grew horns and got all evil?
Well, Jerry was always ambitious. He was very ambitious. He was a real zealot. His first year of school there at Baptist Bible College, there was a local church there called the High Street Baptist Church, and he wanted to have a Sunday school class for 10-year-old boys. They said they didn't have any space, but they did. He kept after them. They finally gave him a little space, and in a matter of 2 months, he had 100 young boys, 10-year-old boys, coming to his Sunday school class. And during my second year, while I was working in a church in Kansas City, and he got a job working on the weekends at another church in Kansas City. So we drove back and forth every weekend from Springfield, 180 miles from Springfield to Kansas City. He sat at our dinner table on Sundays often, and was quite fond of my mother's chocolate meringue pie.
My stars. Well, was he a hearty eater back in the day?
Oh, well, we all were.
And I understand your mom even baked pies for him, or for you both, from time to time.
Oh, yeah. She made three or four, so we always had one or two to take back with us.
Jerry, how do you explain the journey of the two of you through the same school, taught the same things, yet you turned out to be a very, very different person than Jerry Falwell. Jerry Falwell seemed to stick to the very fundamental basics throughout, and in such a aggressive way. Did you see differences in the students there that could you sort of spot the ones, or what did you think of Jerry? Did you ever envision that he would turn out as he did?
Well, I envisioned that he was always going to be the pastor of a large church, because he had that. That was one of the things that they taught us there. The Baptist Bible Fellowship churches had many mega churches long before the word ever came into use, and reports that there were only half a dozen mega churches before 1970 is simply not true. The Baptist Bible Fellowship had many churches that were running well over 2,000 in attendance, some of them running up to 5,000 in attendance way back in the 50s.
Wow.
And that's what they taught us, that there was no barriers, that you were to go out and win the lost, and actually, you know, we were taught the bigger the number, the better it was. And so,
well, Jerry, back.
No doubt that he was going to pastor a large church.
Yes. Well, Jerry, back in the 50s, these churches with 2,000 people, and we're referring to them as mega churches, indeed, I agree, did they have the sort of outreach, what we see in mega churches today with the swimming pools and the
no.
soccer games, the 24-hour?
No.
Where were they lying?
No, everything was strictly church. You know, they didn't have bowling alleys and didn't have Burger King in them, and you know, like you say, the swimming pools and all that. No, they were, everything was strictly church. And
I see.
The idea now that these church plants have Starbucks and Burger King and all that other stuff would have been completely foreign. The preachers just simply would not have stood for it. It'd been too worldly.
I understand. Well, Jerry, back in the days when you were, and by the way, one of the folks in chat has pointed out that that perhaps this particular group of Baptists was once referred to as the hard shell Baptists. Have you heard that before?
Yeah, that's really not true. Hard shell Baptists were you know, me and my wife, my son John and his wife, us four and no more. Real predestinarian, and these guys weren't predestinarian. They were fundamental evangelical, missionary, premillennial Baptist.
And I see.
Missions was a big focus of sending missionaries out all over the world.
Well, Jerry, it had to be a very. I'm trying to wrap my head
right,
around.
You're right. You're right. We also, you know, it was also the I don't dance and I don't chew and I don't go with girls that do. You know,
that's kind of funny.
You had all these don'ts that added up, were supposed to add up to a positive that you were not a worldly Christian.
I see. Well, in the small intersection caution light community that I grew up in, Jerry, there was a Methodist church and there was a Baptist church. And, you know, there was a common Easter sunrise service. You know, they joined together from time to time. So there wasn't any animosity, but the Methodists used to say that the Baptists were just Methodists who weren't allowed to dance. And in a small town, it's very much like that. But, Jerry, back in those days, you know, we see such strident anti-gay, anti-lesbian speech from the leaders these days. It must have been turned down or toned down to a large degree. And what was it like being someone who ended up being an activist to attend a college? Was it overt anti? What'd they teach about Sodom and Gomorrah and all that?
You know,
how did that work?
Sure. Well, gay people weren't out, so to speak. I mean, you'd heard maybe there were bars for queer people. But it wasn't a big thing like today, because the gay movement, because our movement came out strong, we became a target, we were a perfect target for the fundamentalists, and particularly after the Berlin Wall fell and there weren't any commies to kick around anymore, in the 90s they really turned their attention to us.
I see. So it was more benign back in the day. So it's not that Jerry Falwell was lecturing or even say, not that he knew about you, but it wasn't that it was something that was constantly discussed. It was sort of a general nod of understanding preached.
Not preached. I mean, possibly when the preacher was, you know, preaching out of 1 Corinthians 6 and they ran across it, there would be some brief statement, but you know, you didn't spend an hour talking about it from the pulpit, and it was very, you know, it was very quiet. In those days, at Baptist Bible College, as I told you, I was very young. I was 16 when I first set my size irons on the sacred sod at Baptist Bible College. I had my 17th birthday after I got down there, and you know, I didn't know who I was in those days. I knew I had crushes on boys. But I didn't have, you know, I didn't have a word for it or anything like that. And it was after I, around my 22nd year that, I realized that I was, you know, hopelessly, attracted to men. And, word got around, my church, and my pastor called me in and said, you know, if you're this way, get out. We don't want you. So I just never went back.
No, that's touching, Jerry. I was 16 at some point in the 60s, if I can remember back that far. And I remember even then, coming from the background I came from, I didn't have a word either. I remember going to the encyclopedia in high school to try to find out a word for what I was. People don't really always get it about what it's like when you don't even have a word.
Yeah, well, that's it. You couldn't go to the library, and if you did went to the library and you looked up anything about same-sex attractions, it was a perversion. You were sick, and there was nothing positive about being gay.
And, yes, this is before the I was going to say it's before the Psychiatric Administration.
Yeah, before the APA changed the nomenclature in 1973. And so any book, almost any book you picked up on the subject put you down. And I remember Troy Perry talking about, he tried when he started coming out and he very tried to spend, and that's and that's why he started the Metropolitan Community Churches. It wasn't there. I mean, our young people, I'm thankful today that our young people can come, just bouncing out of the closet at age 13 and start looking for a husband.
Which is what everybody else does, by the way. So why shouldn't they? There's a question in the chat room wondering about the gay religious experience. Now, I know you've come through a long way from coming from a Baptist Bible college to being a minister, I'd love to talk about your journey and how you got from there to where you are now, because that's one heck of a trip. But there is a question in the chat room regarding the gay religious experience as opposed to other elements in the gay community. In other words, the question is, are there gay fundamentalists?
Oh yes. You can find them out. You can find them online. There's several websites online that I can't think of this one young man's name. I mean, God, I just shake my head every time I go on his site and look at what he's doing. He's just strictly a gay fundamentalist. And he has, a lot of people that subscribe to his website and so on.
Well, I have to tell you
within the Metropolitan Community Churches, you have a wide range of belief, because one of the successful things that Troy Perry did is he took people from every religious background, every Christian religious background, from Christian Science to roll them on the floor Pentecostals, and put them under one roof, worshiping together.
Yes.
And nobody's ever been able to do that.
Well, that's so true. My mind boggles. To begin with, this fellow who's running the site, does he even attempt to address his orientation, or is it other sorts of fundamentalism that he always talks about?
No, he acknowledges that he's gay, abstinence.
Like the ex-gay movement, like the Genesis pit. What is it called? The various ex-gay.
Yeah, almost like Exodus. Yeah, but I mean, he wants people to be out wedding people for Christ, and no sex before marriage or whatever whatever he looks at in the way of a relationship. And you take even the Evangelical Concern Group, Dr. Ralph Blair's group. They're primarily fundamentalist people, and there was a guy who a minister in the Metropolitan Community Churches who pastored a church in Phoenix, who was a Baptist graduate of Baptist Bible College, incidentally, and he wound up leaving the MCC and starting another church because MCCs weren't New Testament churches. So as gay people, we stretch the rainbow.
Well, Jerry, can you explain more about what you mean by New Testament churches?
Autonomous local churches. Like in the Baptist sense, where every Baptist church is local, and there's no higher authority than the local church, and
that's dangerous.
That's what Baptists call New Testament churches.
I see. That's a detail I didn't know. Well, Jerry, I met Troy many years back, and I have to share with you that I too was involved in organizing a Metropolitan Community Church in Tallahassee. Now, this was many, many years ago, and eventually that church faded away into oblivion, and it just wasn't anymore. And then several years after that, another group restarted the church. It's not that I lost interest. I actually moved away. And then for whatever reason, the core group dissolved after a year or so after I left. I don't know why. But in any case, there's another group, and they've started the church. It's been active for a long, long time. So I get it about metropolitan community churches. And you're talking about including the fundamentalists and the Catholics and the people who roll on the floor. It's an amazing mix when you go into an MCC. You see elements of the Catholic Church and the robes, and you see the casualness of the enthusiasm. It's a very strange place to be.
Well, do you know that, several years ago, the National Church tried to join the National Council of Churches, and several years they went as observers and so on. Do you know that the National Council of Churches, all the membership of the National Council of Churches, the people who attend those meetings and everything, never had a communion service? And it took MCC to show them how to do communion.
I'll be darned. Well, that's an interesting thing about MCC. I don't know if they all do it, but the MCCs I have been to have communion at every service, whereas the Methodist Church does.
Yeah, it's in the Bible.
Yeah, it is, but okay. Wasn't sure. The Methodist Church does it a little differently.
Right. Well, yeah, that was something I had to get used to. Why can't you cut those? Give me those little shot glasses.
Well, eventually, when I was, I'm more active in a Methodist church now, but I do occasionally go to the MCC here. And what I find once a month is what I was accustomed to, as opposed to doing it every Sunday. Well, Jerry, from a graduate of the Baptist Bible College to a minister in, I should say, several large metropolitan community churches. These were not small, were they? Were there more than one?
Yeah, most of the churches I've been associated with were small churches. My church in Des Moines, I started the church in Des Moines. I mean, I started from scratch there, and same way in Wichita, and built went in 6 or 8 months' time, had the regular attendance built up to around 50.
But you see, that's large for MCC years ago.
Let somebody else take it over. My church in Wichita, or in Fort Worth, where I was senior pastor, was very small. It only had we had less than 50 or 60 members, and but we were it was active, and the church out here in Sacramento was a woman preacher here for many, many years, and she was a dynamic pastor, dynamic preacher. And but I left MCC in 1981, and I've been studying, doing a lot of studying, and I just came to the point where I one of the things they never taught us in Baptist Bible College is where the Bible came from. And as I started studying on my own, I looked around and started finding out how the Bible came into being, and came to realize that most of the stories in the Bible were a collection of myths from other cultures around that surrounded the Jewish nation, and they simply incorporated some of those stories into their religion. And there's in my opinion, there's no proof that Jesus Christ ever lived.
Well, certainly in the,
let alone
the fundamentalist church. Yes. Yeah. Well, there you go. There's certainly in the fundamentalist churches. There's no room for dissent,
no.
And there's certainly no room for any intellectual study of the Bible and its history. In fact, that's one of the reasons I believe fundamentalists are so hysterical about getting everyone to be a fundamentalist too, is because they realize that many of their positions, if not all of them, are indefensible.
Right.
By joining them, you become blind to some of those issues too. So you've really run the gamut.
Yeah,
it's quite a journey. Well, you know, moving back to Sacramento, there, you've been there for 28 years. What in the heck, or the hell, as I should say, is going on in Sacramento? And I understand some other areas of the country where the watch from the walls is so many Russian immigrants and
right.
What is going on? This is insane.
We're using the term Slavic because of some Slavic countries. They're not just Russians. They're Slavic countries.
Yeah.
A lot of them are from the Ukraine and Belarus and, you know, this stan and that stan. What happened here in Sacramento is that there was a radio broadcast that was broadcast into Russia for many years. And before the Iron Curtain fell, these Russians would listen to that, or not these Russians, these Slavic people would listen to this broadcast. And they came to think of Sacramento as the promised land. And many of them, when they were able to, were actually persecuted in their, you know, in their home countries. Pastors were imprisoned. Church members were fired from their jobs. That type of thing. And so many of them, thousands of them, were able to immigrate into the United States under religious persecution policies of our government. And as a result of that, because of this radio broadcast, thousands of them came to Sacramento and settled here. We have, in our area alone, we have about somewhere between 80 and 100 different Slavic churches.
Wow.
Now Sacramento is, the greater Sacramento area is somewhere around 2 million people.
Yes.
And we have this Slavic population of approximately 120,000, and of that 120,000, about 40,000 of them are evangelical Christians.
Wow!
And we have three of those 80 to 100 churches. Three of them are mega churches. One of them has an attendance of over 5,000 every Sunday. And the other two run well over 2,000 every Sunday.
Wow.
And I think originally they were probably contacted by Lou Sheldon of the Traditional Values Coalition. Here in Sacramento, we have a number of evangelical front groups. Focus on the Family has their lobbying group here, several other independent groups, and they
being the capital, yes,
yeah, you know, there'd be legislation, gay friendly legislation, making its way through the legislature, and so they tried to rally the troops to come down and demonstrate and lobby against. Whatever the bill was, and weren't having much success, and so they turned to these Slavic churches, and they started pouring people down to the Capitol. They busload them down there, you know, to appear in these rallies out on what we call the West Step, and
yes.
You'd see these little old dumpy ladies in their babushkas with their little signs, you know, saying homosexuality is sin and. Stuff like that, and then they started picketing our gay event, our gay youth day down at the Capitol, where we have young people come in from all over the state and go lobby the legislature, and they started trying to, 3 or 4 years ago, they tried to prevent the kids from going into the building. And then 3 years ago, they started picketing our gay pride parade. Well, we hadn't had parades for several years, and about 2 years ago we started having parades again, and they're out there picketing our parades. They're spitting on people, they're shoving people around, and but they were egged on to doing this by these other groups. You know, they really have been kind of misled, but on the other hand, they feel that they have come to this country because the American Evangelical Church is not doing its job. They backslid. They're apostate almost. And they have come to bring America back to God. They are missionaries to America.
So these people are being used and preconditioned and probably taught that it's the LGBT community who wants to take away religious freedom.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, when you talk to some of them, you say, well, you know, didn't your, particularly if you're talking to young people, you say, well, didn't your parents come here to escape religious persecution? Yeah. Well, then what gives you the right to come down here to our gay fair and persecute us, because of your religion? And all they do is, well, the Bible says, you know, and
the Bible says,
they've been well indoctrinated, and everything you put to them, it's the Bible says.
Yes, there's no talking to them, especially when they're members of such large groups. And I assume these large churches have their own radio stations and television programs. What is the media like for them?
Well, they don't have. There is a Russian radio station and several Russian language radio stations. There's one radio station and the guy that owns that, who also owns one of the local Russian publications, is a co-founder of the Watchman.
I'll be darned. So then there's no lack of religious programming on these outlets.
No. So the police have called them in and they've got the right to protest. That's First Amendment. And we're not objecting to that. We say, you want to go down to the Capitol and protest, that's fine. And even if you want to protest at our parades and events, that's fine. But you can't come in and spit on people and shove them around and be physical with them. And so the chief of police has called their leaders into his office and told them, there are acceptable behaviors and there are not acceptable behaviors. And if you spit on people and you push people around, you're going to be arrested.
Well, Jerry, some of the things I have read recently about this is that the LGBT community in the Sacramento area is surprised that something like what happened to Mr. Singh didn't happen years ago, and they expect it to get worse. What is your feeling? Do you feel that these people are listening to the authorities, or is there zealous? They're coming to the United States to bring evangelicalism, the evangelical community. Back to what is the deal?
I think the death of Satinder Singh has set them back a little bit. Yes, I mean it's taken them back somewhat. It's like the militia movement prior to the bombing in Oklahoma City. You know, these guys were going to take over government buildings, and they were going to do this, and they were going to do that. And so when what's his name bombed the Oklahoma City, or bombed the federal building there in Oklahoma City, they all headed for the hills. You didn't hear a word out of them. Haven't heard them since, so to speak. And so I think they have been taken back, and also they haven't they weren't prepared for the public reaction to Satinder's death, in that it caused a coalition to be formed of Hispanics and Asians and gays, called the Satinder Singh Coalition and the Justice for Satinder Coalition. And we've been at every court hearing that the one guy whom they've charged with at least being a part of the group, we've been at every court hearing, and we'll continue to be at court hearings. And there's just been quite a community reaction to what happened with his death.
Well, Jerry, as part of the contrast, as part of their shock, due to the fact that what I've read about being in the Slavic countries, when the Uyghur groups tried to get together to have a gay pride parade, that the police actually actually are much harder on the people in the parade than the people who are beating them up. In other words,
that's been particularly true in Moscow. Now, they've been able to have some successful events in St. Petersburg, which seems to be a much more liberal city. The real block in Moscow has been the mayor himself refusing to issue the permit. See, they can only apply for the permit 10 days before the event. That's the law. And so, but he's not been willing to give them any permit there in Moscow. And when Nikolai Alexeyev says, well, we're going to do it anyway, then the skinheads, the little Nazi skinheads, and the little old Russian Orthodox ladies with their icons come down and start beating them up.
It's tragic. It's just the laughter is provoked by the little old ladies with their icons.
They got these little old ladies down there swinging their icons at them.
Oh, dear Lord. Jerry, what a world. What a world we live in. Well,
it's dangerous in Moscow. It's been dangerous in Moscow for gay men. I don't even remember the exact period of time, but it was during 2007. In a six-month period of time, they had 58 gay men murdered in Moscow.
I see.
Most of it by these young skinheads.
Yes, the skinheads, they are, if I understand correctly, they are being highly motivated by this book called The Pink Swastika, which is written by someone in this group.
Lively wrote The Pink Swastika.
Ah, yes, thank you. Lively. Now, are the evangelicals also being motivated by that book, or are they being motivated using different carrots?
Well, are you talking about the evangelical Slavs or evangelicals here in the country?
The ones in this country, I suppose. Is that book being marketed to them?
I'm talking about regular evangelicals opposed to the Slavic evangelicals. Yeah, the Slavic evangelicals, yes, it's been a big seller with them. It's been a big seller. He's in its, I don't know, umpteenth printing. It's been a big seller in the various Slavic countries, in Belarus and the Ukraine particularly, and Latvia and Lithuania and Estonia.
Does this book present the rewriting of the Holocaust in a religious way? In other words, that this is what the gays rose up against God and executed the Jews?
How does this work? Not so much that. He just says that there were these high-ranking Nazis who were gay, who orchestrated the Holocaust all the way from Hitler down.
I see. The same way the Jews are supposed to run the banking.
There's claims that Hitler was a street hustler in his young
days. Yes, I heard that he lived in a hostel that was known for its call boys.
Yeah. And you know, I can't remember all, and it's been a long time since I've read the book. Genuine historians, you know, just discount everything that's in the book. It really surprised me that it didn't gain wide acceptance here in the United States, among evangelicals here in the United States. I thought it'd be kind of like some of these Christian historic revisionist books about America being a Christian nation and everything. I thought it'd be kind of be taken like that. When the book first came out, I thought, God, we're going to be beaten over the head with this thing. But I've never heard anybody quote it. high-ranking evangelicals in this country quote it.
You at least think that it would fall in line with something like the Left Behind series as fiction that's probably
or Paul Cameron. You know, we keep running into his crap all the time. His faulty studies. We keep hearing them quote that stuff all the time. But anyway, I've not heard anybody make any quotes about from the pink swastika here in this country from, you know, from any even any regular evangelical source.
Well, Jerry, you've used the term that the community, at least in Sacramento, has been taken back by the outcry from the community about the murder of Mr. Singh. What is your gut level feeling? Do you think this is a permanent sort of you're in another country now, back off, and they're going to take it seriously, or is this are they just gathering their forces for the next wave? What is your gut level?
I'm
just concerned.
I think they're going to continue because as I say, they believe, these churches believe that they've been sent here as missionaries to America to bring America back to God. So I think they're going to continue in some program. They may eventually slide off of picketing us and choosing us as their prime target, but I think they're going to be around. One of the things that Scott Lively is doing right now, Scott used to work, was originally from Oregon, and up there in Oregon, he worked with a guy by the name of Lon Maybon, who was able to get a number of anti-gay ballots on the initiative on the ballot up there, and you know they had some big fights on like a thing called Prop 9 that would have put us all in camps or something. Lon was Scott was kind of a disciple of Maybon, and then he went to law school down at some Christian Reconstructionist law school down in the LA area, and then settled here in Sacramento. It's been in Sacramento for a number of years, but a couple of months ago he moved to Springfield, Massachusetts, where he is on the staff of a branch of the Regeneration Church out of Riga, Latvia. And Scott is now has taken up with the Minutemen, these guys who have been going down to the border trying to prevent Mexicans from crossing the border. And they're holding meetings now called Shake the Nation. They just had one this weekend in Springfield. They're getting ready to do one later in the month early May, one of the two, with Alan Keyes and Dave Dubu Meyer, I think it is, who is the founder of the Minutemen, and Scott, and a couple other of these preachers, do a Shake the Nation, and I believe it's Boise, and they're scheduling them all around the country. So it kind of looks like maybe he's trying to hook up the Minutemen and these Slavic evangelicals. For what purpose?
Good Lord.
But it looks like that's what he's heading toward. I hadn't talked to my friend back in Massachusetts who was supposed to attend the meeting this weekend to see what actually happened.
Well, if we're talking about moving the Minutemen from shooting brown people to people who don't have sex the correct way, then we're talking about something very disturbing going on. That it isn't disturbing enough.
Yeah, it's a bothersome to think about what they can do. Some of these preachers, I read some. I forgot to send that to you, that flyer. But I looked up some of these guys on the internet, and like this one preacher out of Warsaw, Ohio, goes around to gay-friendly mainline churches, you know, a Methodist church or Episcopal church, something like that, where they accept gay people. And when they have their time of, their quiet time when they're taking prayer requests and stuff, he stands up and starts berating them for being gay-friendly.
Lord have mercy.
And interrupts their worship service.
Well, you've mentioned Alan Keyes, and I think many of the, if probably all of the listeners to this network anyway, know what a monster he is. And I started doing some looking up today on the web myself, and regarding the Minutemen, and this article goes back to 2006, back in September, but the article is pointing out the fact that Alan Keyes is pretty much controlled by, or rather the Declaration Alliance, is pretty much controlled by Alan Keyes, and that lately the Minutemen are at least the fellow who was in charge in 06 was saying that the Minutemen was a project of the Declaration Alliance, as if they were trying to move themselves under the wing of that organization. What in the hell is Alan Keyes up to?
Well, Alan, a month or so ago, declared that he was leaving the Republican Party and was going to seek the presidential nomination of the Constitutional Party. The Constitutional Party had its roots back in around 96 or so when it started down in New Orleans. They had their first meeting, and it was originally called the U.S. Taxpayers Party. And one of the major speakers at that event was R.J. Rushdoony, who is known as the father of Christian Reconstructionism, and that's the group that would do away with the Constitution and install biblical law as the law of the land. And so, and every candidate that they have run since then has been a Christian Reconstructionist.
Well, Jerry, tell us more about the Christian Reconstructionists and this. What do you think the flow of funding is to get these people elected? And I understand you folks back in when you formed, we haven't even talked about Project Toxin yet. You formed that back in 02 because of suddenly money began flowing in. Is this related to the Christian Reconstructionists?
Well, when the money started flowing here in California in 1992, yes. We had a very unique situation in that we had five millionaires form their own PAC, and they started sponsoring candidates for the state legislature on the Republican ticket. And one of the things their strategy was is they just gave these candidates so much money that other people would, I mean, before the election, before they even started campaigning, they gave these guys big bucks, you know, start them off with a $100,000 donation, that type of thing. And other candidates would look at it and just throw up their hands saying, or potential candidates saying, I can't compete with that. These guys got so much money, I'll never be able to raise enough money to, you know, even get a mailer out. And they were relatively successful. Here in California, we have many safe seats for our legislature. There are very few seats that ever are really contestable. And there are safe Republican seats and safe Democratic seats. And so far, basically now, the religious right has control of probably 90% of the Republican seats in the legislature, in both the Senate and the Assembly.
Wow.
And Howard Amundson was one of the men who was a leader and a big financier of this little quintet. Howard Amundson was the heir to the home savings and loan fortune, which is now Washington Mutual. The Amundson family fortune was developed. You go down to L.A. and the Amundson family, his father, Howard's father, was very generous with Los Angeles, and they have all kinds of civic things down, you know, music hall and concert hall and stuff like that. And it's all got the Amundson name on it. But he made his fortune in buying up land cheap from Japanese who were being incarcerated by Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Oh, my. Mm-hmm. That's amazing to me.
But Howard, as a young man, came under the influence when he was 22, 23, came under the influence of R.J. Rushdoony and sat on Rushdoony's board for 23 years and gave him millions of dollars. And in Rushdoony's society, there are no prisons. You steal a loaf of bread from the 7-Eleven store, you would be indentured to the 7-Eleven store and work for them until you're paid back the price of that loaf of bread plus interest. Everything else is a capital crime. he has 19 categories of capital crime, including juvenile delinquency, not being a virgin, homosexuality, blasphemy, and he defined blasphemy as promoting any other religion other than Christianity. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was just going to ask if then this reconstructionist, the concept is to reconstruct everything back to the Old Testament. It seems like, in other words, I'm thinking that the punishment for these additional crimes you just mentioned are all death. You use capital, but is the death by the Old Testament method? Is that what he's saying,
stoning.
Too?
Stoning, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And you use stones because they're a renewable resource. You can use them over and over again.
Well, Rush Dooney, I've read his name. I'm trying to place him. Did I read him that he was part of somehow the Institute of Religion and Democracy?
No. He passed away. Well, but the Amundsens are part of that. Mrs. Amundsen is on their board of advisors on the Institute of Religion and Democracy. And he has contributed to people who are trying to disrupt the Presbyterian Church. He's contributed to people who are trying to disrupt the Methodist Church, and he certainly has contributed to people trying to disrupt the Episcopalian Church. But he left in 1995 or 96, he left the board of the Chalcedon Institute, which was Rush Dooney's organization, and became a member of the Claremont Institute. And I think he did that because some of us, some writers like Fred Clarkson and myself and others had still brought out the truth about what these reconstructionists were trying to do, that he had to try and find a little better company to keep if he wanted to be relevant in the political situation here in California.
Well, Jerry, it's my understanding that the IRD slash reconstructionists, I kind of use those two terms interchangeably, that their purpose, of course, is to divide the churches by bringing up irrelevant, divisive issues to turn the church to the use of the government as opposed to the message of Christ. Now, and I have said on this show that I feel that process has really already taken place in at least a large part of the Baptist Church. Certainly the Methodist Church is under siege along with others. What do you know of the connections between the Reconstructionists and the Baptist Church?
Within the Southern Baptist Convention, the leaders Paige Patterson and Judge what was his name, the judge from down there in Houston, several of them were all members of the Council for National Policy, and these guys, you know, started their fight to take over the Southern Baptist Convention back in the 80s, maybe even the late 70s.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I had somebody send me this anonymous drawing in 13 steps of how they plan to take over the Southern Baptist Convention. And they did it.
This
was sent to me anonymously. I have no idea where it came from, but it worked. And they're doing basically the same thing in the Episcopal Church and the Methodist Church and the Presbyterian Church. And they call themselves, these groups within these various denominations call themselves renewal groups. But renewal is not their goal. Their goal is to disrupt the entire denomination and tear it apart.
Bob has pointed out in production chat that regarding the Georgia Baptist Convention, that the Christian Reconstructionists have permission to use their state retreat complex and planning facilities, which really doesn't surprise me, because these relationships become very, very cozy over a period of time.
Right.
And, you know, one wonders, the Catholic Church seems to be not a target. Do you think this is because the Catholic Church is already so conservative? Not that all of them, not that all the people are, but
when you look at the board of the IRD, you also see that it's the majority of its board members are Roman Catholic.
Ah, yes, yes, I had forgotten that connection.
It's a pincer movement by the Roman Catholic Church to destroy the Protestant Church in America. That's really what it is. And you see all this stuff with abortion and all that. That all crept into the American evangelical churches through the charismatic movement. It's when the charismatic Catholics started fellowshipping with, your average roll them on the floor Pentecostal, that this thing about abortion took over the American evangelical church. When I was a kid in Sunday school, and my pastor from the pulpit never talked about, well, I mean, when he talked about when life began, you became a living soul when you breathed in the breath of life.
And I remember, yes.
Adam, you were Adam's lump of clay.
Yes. Yes, yes, I remember. In fact, I've referred to that that it was the first breath that the soul was to enter the body, and that's biblical, not the when the cells meet.
Right.
Right.
Now it's just a common accepted doctrine within most evangelical churches that life begins at conception, which was the Catholic position, Roman Catholic position. But I think what the bishops have done in setting about with the anti-abortion movement and what they're doing with the IRD and so on, it's a pincer movement to destroy Protestantism in this country. And that's not, what? I'm not trying to be anti-Catholic or anything else. It's just the way I see it.
Well, go ahead,
please.
The
Catholic Church does a lot of good works in this country and does a lot of great charity work through their Catholic Charities and so on.
Well, yes. This is an interesting perspective. It's not one that I had heard put quite like that way, but when you consider the makeup of the Institute on Religion and Democracy, you have to wonder, to what degree do you think the Institute of Religion and Democracy is involved, the IRD, is involved with funding for the mega churches? In other words, the situation with the Slavic people, I'm getting to this. You have a wonderful chart on your site. In fact, I posted that chart at the Strictly Confidential. If you'd like to look at this, it's being posted in the chat room. Yeah, at strictlyconfidentialradio.com, you'll go to today's date. You'll see the California Theocracy chart, and you can click on that and look at this. This took an incredible amount of work, and the IRD is at least as complicated as that. I've seen a chart
trying to
explain the IRD, and it's just overwhelming.
That chart's 10 years old. I mean, it needs to be updated. I could add all kinds of groups to it, but it still gives you a general oversight of how these guys all work together and cooperate together, and they sit out there in Colorado Springs and hold all, because they're all located in Colorado Springs now, they hold these secret meetings. I've got audio tapes of a meeting that was held in Colorado Springs at the Navigators headquarters. Several big officials were focused on the family. There were, I don't know how many different organizations represented at this particular meeting, but they sat down and they planned out their agenda on how to attack the gay community over the next 10 years, and they've been doing it. And they're starting way back in '98 with their big campaign where they were running their ads and all that sort of thing. And said during the whole 7 hours, said terrible things about it. Just so happened that a friend of mine somehow got a hold of these tapes and made copies for me, so I have them in my possession. But these groups that are out there, as I say, in Colorado Springs, nobody's paying any attention to them except maybe folks looking to focus on the family once in a while, and they're all sitting out there plotting politically and religiously and every other way, and you know, we never know what's happening till they hit us.
Wow. Well, you know, our producer has also brought up the Mel Gibson's church that he built in Malibu, and apparently that's part of the Opus Dei movement. Do you know where that fits in? You're a fascinating guest. I'm trying to pick as much as I can.
I'm not that familiar with Opus Dei. I mean, I know that, you know, I know they're out there. I know they're doing things. But I you know, it's just like that FBI guy that became the Soviet spy for all those years was a member of Opus Dei and stuff like that. Opus Dei has always been just too overwhelming for me. It's such a secretive organization, and I mean, it's like the Moonies. They're just everywhere.
Yeah.
And that's another source of money that nobody, the media rarely ever talks about. Moon is pumping money into all kinds of things in this country. You know, Jerry Falwell, the Washington Times does an annual awards thing. And Falwell has, before he died, two or three times served as the... master of ceremony, the Reverend Moon, and of course Moon gave him money.
Yeah,
and then you had the crowning ceremony, Moon being crowned King of the Universe or whatever there in the
we talked about that on not this show but another show on this network. I think it was Bob's show talked about it was in a Senate office building, was it not? It was pretty amazing.
And you had all these legislators, all these members of Congress and these senators all carrying his crown, and just disgusting.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was about to say that someone in chat pointed out that from their perspective, the Christian Reconstructionists are to the Protestants what Opus Dei is to the Catholics. I think is if I'm understanding
that sounds like a good yeah.
It sounded about right to me.
You have a number of people in this country, religious people, who are what I call Christian nationalists. But there's only two ways for a Christian nationalist to go. Two things for them to do. They either have to come to the realization of what Christian nationalism is and realize that it's wrong and renounce it, like Cal Thomas and Frankie Schaefer Jr. and even the guy that's head of Rutherford Institute have done. Or you're going to become a Christian Reconstructionist. There's no in between.
I see.
You're either going to say, hey, this is wrong, this is un-American, this is against the Constitution, or you're going to just keep charging ahead, and you're eventually going to say, God should be ruling everything, and we are God's regents on earth, therefore we should be ruling everything.
Interesting. Now, someone just pointed out too that Justice Scalia is a member of Opus Dei. The chat room is an amazing place. Some of the smartest people. In fact, if it were not for the chat room, I would be a stumbling. I have a cast of characters who keep me in line. Jerry, we haven't talked about Sloan versus Falwell. Now, this is another chapter that I promised that what's up with Sloan? Now, he's your old buddy. He's your old college buddy from the Bible college, and I assume you communicated from time to time through the years. What? How in the world did you get in a lawsuit with Sloan versus Falwell? What happened?
Well, in 1984, Jerry had come out to California to harass the Democrats at their convention. And while he was out here in San Francisco, but being so close to Sacramento, 90 miles, we had an early morning talk show called Look Who's Talking. And it had live audience and so on. And their producers were friends. One of the producers was a friend of a guy that I worked closely with. And he knew that I'd gone to school with Falwell. So he gave me a bunch of tickets because we want you to be in the audience. So I went to the audience, and when the host, Jim Finnerty, came around to me, I acknowledged Jerry, and he acknowledged me. He said, oh, yes, we go way back. And then I asked him about a quote that I'd heard him make on the Old Time Gospel Hour about the Metropolitan Community Churches. And I had seen this. Actually, it had been reported in The Advocate several months before that. And I came home from work one morning and was listening to his telecast, and lo and behold, here he is saying it on his national telecast. And so I rushed out. I didn't have anything. He was on three different times here in Sacramento at the time. And I rushed out and bought a tape recorder so I could catch it on his later broadcast. And I taped what he had to say. And what he said was he kind of departed from his notes. He was preaching out of the book of Jude, and he departed from his notes and said, look at the Metropolitan Community Church today. And that was kind of an aside for him. Normally he always just referred to it as the gay church. He never named it.
Yes.
Gay church. He said, look at the Metropolitan Community Church today. That's what's being talked about here in Jude. He says they're brute beasts. He talked about him trying to get into the National Council of Churches, and he said they're brute beasts, and they're part of a violent satanic system, and one day they're going to be utterly annihilated, and there'll be a celebration in heaven. And I could barely get that quote out, and he's just screaming that's a lie. I never said it. We went round and round, and finally I said, well, I've got it on tape. And he says, I'm saying this on television right here in front of all these people. If you produce that tape, I'll give you $5,000. So this was on Friday the 13th, and I didn't have the tape with me, and so I took that tape and another tape that he himself had produced at headquarters down at Metropolitan Community Churches had it, and they rushed it up to me. And so I took those tapes down to the television station the next week, and they played them and made a telecast out of it and said, well, it sounds like he was quoted accurately, and he probably owes this man $5,000. So I went to a local attorney here, who happened to be a lesbian, and said, will you write him and ask him to send the $5,000 back by return mail? And a week or so later, we get a letter back from his attorney basically saying it'll be a cold day and you know where before we send you $5,000. That I'd knocked the tapes, and I'd done this, and I'd done that.
Doctored the tapes, yes, yes, yes. This is this is your friend. This is someone who went to your mother's house and ate pie and Sunday dinner, right?
Yes, and so he, in November, on November 30th, he was coming back to Sacramento, and this was the heyday of the moral majority. So he was coming back to Sacramento on a fundraising tour, and so an hour or so before his plane left or arrived, we filed our lawsuit in municipal court for breach of oral contract, and met him at the airport. The media was already there because, as I say, this was the height of a moral majority, and they were there to watch his every move and everything, and so some of them were very curious as to why I was out there. A number of them knew who I was, and they were curious as to why I was there, and I said, well, just wait. And so as soon as he got off the plane, we hit him with our process server, and then we eventually went to court, and the judge heard the case, and there was no need for witnesses. Everything was on tape. He even wound up producing furnishing a videotape of his sermon of him saying what I said he said.
Yes.
And so the judge heard all the evidence and the arguments from the attorneys, and eventually ruled in my favor, said he owed me the money, that I'd quoted him accurately and I'd acted within proper time to accept the offer of the oral of his oral contract.
Right, and the judge saw it as an oral contract.
Yeah, and that he owed me the money, and so then he wound up appealing the case on the basis that we had a Jewish judge who was prejudiced against him.
And Lord have mercy, Jewish
judge. That went to the appeals court, and the appeals judge just slapped his attorney out of the courtroom. And then they sanctioned him for wasting their time. And we eventually collected about $9,000. Wasn't a lot of money, but it was the principle of the thing. And then we took a large portion of the money and helped start our gay and lesbian community center here. So Falwell was one of our godfathers of our community center here.
So we know for a fact that Falwell did one good thing.
Yes, and we even dedicated a room to him.
Which room? Oh, that's perfect. The Falwell room. Well, I understand that even though he eventually sent you the funds that you were owed, that he still wanted a stipulation. What was that about?
Oh, yeah. He wanted a... By this time, this thing had been going on for 26 months, and my attorney called me and says, well, Jerry's ready to send you the check, but he wants to put a stipulation on it that you won't call a press conference and boast about getting this money. And at that time, I said, Rosie, tell him to put anything on that check he wants to. My mother will call a press conference and say, look what my kid did.
So here's the money, but I don't want you to reveal that I'm a liar. Is that
right.
Basically a reason?
Yeah, and so, you know, the press knew that we got the money, and they all called, and when they made their stories, they said, we called him, he didn't call us.
I see. Very, very interesting. So that's the story. Did you ever converse with him after that, or was that the end of any...
Never heard from him after that,
I see. And what... He raised his voice. Was he completely like flustered? What was?
Oh yeah,
was
he
melting down?
Yeah, he was unglued. He was
unglued.
When you see the tape, you can see him. He's just you know, it was not Jerry. He was just completely flustered.
I see. And one wonders why, because one wonders why he didn't just stand behind his statement. And rather than deny his statement,
yeah, it was very strange, and you know, because it had been printed in the Advocate, and I know he read the Advocate, or somebody on his staff did, you know, and brought it to him. What actually happened was there were two Presbyterian ministers, college professors. There's a small Presbyterian school there in Lynchburg. And these guys were going to his services and recording, tape recording, everything he said. They eventually wrote a book called Did Jerry Falwell Say That? They were going to write a book. They never got that one out. The original book they put out was Jerry Falwell, An Unauthorized Biography. But they had tons of stuff in it that he said during his prayer meetings and other meetings that he conducted around Lynchburg there, and they happened to take that particular quote and sent it into the Advocate, and the Advocate printed it in like February of 84, and so in June when he was in Sacramento, I had read that statement. It was in March, I think, or April when I saw the broadcast of him making the very same statement. That's why I was so shocked when I saw it on television, because I'd already read it in the Advocate and just thought, well, that's something he said at a prayer meeting or something, not something he's going to say on his national broadcast. And so he knew he made the statement. There was too much publicity out on it already.
Yes. There was already, I see, it had already hit the fan,
yeah.
And he was being confronted on television and you were not his favorite person at that time.
Right.
That's amazing. Well, we'll want to talk about Sloan versus Baptist Bible College because that's a great story. But before we do, tell one of our favorite people here is Rush Limbaugh. Tell us about Sloan versus Limbaugh. People are asking to hear about that.
When Rush was here in Sacramento, that's where he got his national start. He was constantly, always talking about on the local station here, talking about women from now and talking about how ugly they were and everything. And then he was always telling this story about gay men and gerbils. And I was,
yes.
I've been speaking at a gay group down in Modesto, and I was driving back from Modesto, and he started in on that gerbil story, and he said, well, it must be true. I've never had any irate gay person call me up and tell it's not true. And I thought, honey, you want to see an irate queen? I'm going to show you an irate queen.
So it must be true because nobody called up irate. Now, I hate to do this, but some people are scratching their head. What is the gerbil story? So I must ask.
Well, he talked about there's a story that goes back. I've never been able to find the genesis of the story, but it's about gay men inserting gerbils in their rectum.
I was afraid that was the story. I was so hoping that it was another. And I've heard rats and every other sort of rodent.
Oh yeah, all that, yeah. And
yeah,
he was always
yeah.
repeating that story, and I say he talked about these women now being ugly, and it just so happened that the president of the local chapter here was a knockout, beautiful blonde, and I thought I want to get this turkey in a conference room and him sit across from her and tell her she's
yeah.
ugly,
yeah.
And so we filed a complaint with the Human Rights Commission here. And took it up at the radio station. But unfortunately, when we got to the radio station, they said, well, Rush is leaving for New York in 6 weeks. And so we weren't able to pursue it. There wouldn't have been anything they could do to him. And he left and went. But a second time, we had a young man by the name of Vincent Blades murdered right outside of one of our bar area here in Sacramento.
Yeah.
And at his memorial service, I made in my speech, I made some chant about naming a whole bunch of different people that contributed to his death, and I named Rush among them, and that was printed in some of the local gay papers. We have two of them here, and it's printed in the local gay paper, and that came under his, that was brought to his attention, and he was writing a column here in Sacramento, and then he also went on his radio broadcast and said, I'll come back to Sacramento, I'll let the police beat me with a rubber hose.
Oh, yes, typical bravado from Limbaugh.
Yeah, and never wanting to admit that his homophobic rhetoric caused violence to gay people.
I see. So he completely bypassed what you were saying to him and pretended that it was an individual, and I see.
Yeah,
he avoided the point.
And he printed a couple articles in his column in the Sacramento Union, which was very, very conservative paper, and ran his column when he was come back in New York.
I see.
And so that was our years ago, sometime after that, he was in Sacramento for some kind of a dinner award thing. And does the name Christine Kraft mean anything to you?
It's vaguely familiar, and probably Christine I should know, but I don't.
Was an anchor in Kansas City, and they got on her because she wasn't didn't do deference to the male anchor, and they didn't like her makeup and all that sort of stuff, and she wound up suing him, and went all the way to the Supreme Court. She lost them for some reason, but she was a radio personality also out here in Sacramento. She was going to be on the program with him, and I called her up and I said, Christine, if I give you a gerbil, will you present it
Oh, you didn't go there. Oh, my stars. To which I hope she laughed.
Oh, she said, oh, you know I will. But unfortunately, gerbils are illegal in California.
Oh, my stars.
You can't have gerbils and ferrets in California.
Well, I'm sure that that's a huge loss to the gay community, according to Limbaugh. Jerry, another story that you've just got to tell us is Sloan versus the Baptist Bible College.
Yeah. Well,
in the world did that happen?
Well, in 1974, after I went up to moved to Des Moines to start the Metropolitan Community Church up there, the local the church reporter for the Des Moines Register called me. I'd taken a press release down. I didn't have any more sense to say to take a press release down and say we're here. You know, we're queer. Get used to it. to announce that we were holding services she called me back and wanted to know a little more information about me, and I said, yeah, she wanted to know about my education. I said, well, I'm a graduate of the Baptist Bible College in Springfield, Missouri, and she put that in the article. And there were a couple of Baptist Bible Fellowship churches that just, you know, came unglued, and they called Springfield. Springfield called the Des Moines Register and wanted the Des Moines Register to print a retraction. And the Des Moines Register says, we have nothing to retract. He graduated from your school. We have printed the facts as they are. There's nothing to retract. But they told the school if they wanted to make any kind of a disclaimer that they would print that. So she calls me. Jane Bowler was her name. Jane calls me and says, we're going to do this something from the college. And she contacted me several times, and this drug on for about 8 or 10 days, and finally she calls me and says, well, the story's going to be in the paper tomorrow, and I just figured, three paragraphs back by the sports page or something. And so I hobbled down to the business district. I live two blocks from the business district, hobbled down there to a newsstand at noon when the noon edition came out. Looked in the box, and here spread across the front page of the paper was college demands homosexuals diploma back.
They didn't even bother to print your name, eh?
No. So the school wanted me to send my diploma back to them, and I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I work for it. I earned it. I'm going to keep it. And we went down, had a demonstration down there, and my first exposure to, real big media, and it got picked up at the AP, and the story went across the country, that type of thing. Over the years, I've never sent the diploma back, and I have tried to form the Baptist Bible College Gay Alumni Association.
Oh my! You really just know how to. You're a class act, guy. I gotta tell you.
I have found a gay alumni or two along the way.
I'll bet you have.
And
remarkable story.
And the only thing. Well, that's the only thing you can do is you've got to keep after. It's like. These guys are going to be around for a long time. They're still going to be talking about homosexuality and down in this for the next 50 or 100 years. It's like I told you this morning when I was pastoring in Texas. Still heard in 1977. Still heard preachers down there talking about the curse of Ham. That black people were supposed to be Ham being one of Noah's children and the one that he cursed.
Yes, that's huge in the South for you people in the Northeast and the Northwest. The story of Ham. This is the story of black folks, by the way. It's told in the South.
Ham was supposed to be the progenitor of the black race, he was cursed because he saw his father's nakedness or whatever.
I had forgotten that detail. That's why he was cursed, because he saw his father. Oh my stars! This is just ludicrous.
And you still heard it, 100 110 years, 20 years, whatever it was after the Civil War, you still heard preachers down there talking about the curse of Ham. And we're still going to, you know, 50, 7500 years from now, we're still going to hear preachers saying man should not lie with man. They're going to be in a small minority, but they're still going to be around.
Well, Jerry, tell me this. Another tale about the Baptist College. Now, I read that they revoked your diploma or canceled or something. Were you successful in getting them to reinstate that, or was that just a joke?
Well, they spent 4 years. Four years after, in 1978, they sent me a letter saying they had the faculty had met and that they revoked my diploma, but they didn't send a cancel stamp for me to put on it. So.
That's priceless. That because none had ever been printed before is the reason there was no.
Yes. Well, but I mean, can you imagine for 4 years for that to be boiling in their little brains that they had to take the time to do that? Of course, the thing that originally when the vice president Bill Dow wrote me a letter in 1974. He closed it by saying, "We hope that God leads you back to the faith, or wipes your influence from the face of the earth."
That's not subtle. That pretty much means fire and lightning raining down on you, doesn't it?
Just God take a 2x4 and hit him in the head.
Well, Jerry, I have to say that we've barely scratched the surface. I would love to have you back again. It's one of the reasons. Is you're probably the first guest that I've mentioned the IRD has come up that you knew anything about it really to any great, and I think that would be fascinating if we could do that at some point in the future, or maybe even after the Pride event, which you're going to be involved in.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. It's always fun to talk about these things.
Yeah.
You know, the IRD is doing so much work. I went. You remember here in Sacramento around 2000, we had these two women. Have a public ceremony, a union ceremony, and it was performed by 98 Methodist ministers.
Oh, yes. There was a story about that, yeah.
Yeah, and it was held down at the big convention center here in Sacramento. 1,500 people attended. The nuts from Topeka flew in for it, and all, you know, Fred Phelps flew in for it, and all that, then these ministers were all brought up on trial for allegedly violating the laws of the Methodist Church.
Yes, some people don't realize the Methodist Church, you could actually get in a trial, which is really a horrifying aspect of it. I don't know about other religions.
Well,
one
of the interesting things, each minister was allowed to speak. This thing went on for 3 days. And each minister was allowed to speak, and to a person, they all stood up and said how proud they were to have participated in that ceremony. But there were some ministers there from the Renewal Group, and we were able to talk to them. I had press credentials. I was writing for a gay paper, and we talked to these Renewal guys. And they were, you know, they were just dyed-in-the-wool fundamentalists. You don't think of a Methodist as being a fundamentalist.
Well, you really don't. Yes, go ahead.
And they were charismatic, you know, they were charismatic guys. And that's what most of the Renewal groups are. They're all charismatic people. That's one of the things I have tried to get media to do in this day and age. It's not enough to know that somebody's a Methodist or a Presbyterian or whatever. You need to find out if they're a charismatic Presbyterian. I mean, that's almost an oxymoron, but, you know, are they a charismatic Presbyterian? Are they a charismatic Methodist? Are they a charismatic Episcopalian? Because it changes their entire worldview. And they're no longer in line with the traditional doctrines of their denomination.
Well, that's well said. That's a great way to put it too. Rather than simply saying, well, some Methodist churches are this way or some Episcopal churches are this way, to just bring it down to the bottom line is, are they charismatic?
Yeah.
I think that's great. Well, Jerry, I must thank you. The chat room has been intently listening. In fact, I can always tell when people are listening because the chat comes to a stop, you know, because everybody's listening rather than typing. So you were certainly well received, and I have personally enjoyed talking with you very much, and you're a delightful guest, a delightful man. I'm so glad that our paths have crossed.
Yes, indeed.
And when you come back, we'll talk more about Project Toxin, which we have completely overlooked, I'm sorry to say, but there's a lot to be said about that too.
Yeah, we did a lot with Toxin. I think we actually changed the course of politics here in California, in that we were able to get the word out about who these candidates were, and the media picked up on it, and were able to stop a lot of it.
Wonderful.
From
what I've gathered, Project Toxin is also the go-to organization for information for people like CBS, NBC, CNN. In other words, the organization is well respected as a go-to point organization.
We have been indeed, and tried to always, you know, back up our research with lots of footnotes.
Wonderful, fascinating, Jerry, and I'd love to have you back to talk. We'll talk about more about Toxin and also about the IRD or anything else that comes up. And thank you again.
All right, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, sir. Good evening to you, and I'll be sure and get you a copy of the audio.
Okay.
And my friends, yes, sir. Thank you, my friends. That is my friends. I sound like Limbaugh. That was Jerry Sloan, a remarkable man who's led a remarkable life with remarkable stories. And if anyone has the right to be called an activist, it is this man. And in fact, I'm told he's called the godfather of gay rights in Sacramento, which we'll find out about when we have him on this show next time. Now, we do have a gay bar across the street segment for this evening, and our DJ tonight is Mr. Bobby Vittoretti, and I'm excited about this segment. It's a wonderful segment. It was done back in, we're taking it from a Bobby Vittoretti reel-to-reel tape done back in 1985 when he was playing at The Rage in West Hollywood, he's been on the show. You've heard Bobby. He's one of the pioneers. You can find out all about Bobby at www.bobbyvittoretti.com. That's V-I-T-E-R-I-T-T-I. That's Bobby Vittoretti, VITERITTI.com. So as we head across the street to the little gay bar,
across the alley was the Paradise Dance Hall. Evenings in spring, they'd open all the doors and windows, and the music would come outside. Sometimes they'd turn out all the lights except for a large glass sphere that hung from the ceiling. It would turn slowly about and filter the dusk with delicate rainbow colors.
my friends, that was none other than Mr. Bobby Vitaretti. You can find out more about Bobby at B.O.